Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, three responses to the election of Donald Trump and the broader Republican wave. We'll hear from two political scientists, Jody Dean and Alex Gurevich, with the journalist Glenn Ford in between. Before them, a few words. Analyses of Trump's victory coming from liberals and leftists emphasize how whites and men in particular drove his victory out of racism and misogyny. There was plenty of that for sure, but this explanation is complicated by the fact that Hillary did much worse among white voters, particularly in the industrial Midwest, than Obama did in 2012. Also, Hillary's winning primary coalition, upper-income whites and black and Latino voters, didn't translate into the general. Yes, she lost badly among white men, but she got over 1.5 million fewer votes from that demographic than Obama did 4 years ago. More strikingly, she got almost 1.5 million fewer votes from black women than Obama did, and 500,000 fewer from black men. She also lost votes among Hispanic men and women relative to 4 years ago. She even slipped, though very slightly, among white women. Overall, Hillary's defeat came from a decline in Democratic votes, not a surge in Republican ones. First, Jody Dean. Jody, a frequent guest in this show, teaches politics at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. She's the author most recently of Crowds and Party from Verso. So, Jody, are you recovering from the shock of the news?
I think I'm still within the shock field. It's hard to get one's head around the collapse of the hegemony we've been within from the last 30 years, right? The hegemony of Clintonian neoliberalism. And now we're kind of in the rubble of this, and it'll be a challenge and interesting to see how we make our ways through.
Someone whom you know well and have written about, who is in a bit of a doghouse among folks on the left now, Slavoj Žižek said recently that there might be some reasons to welcome a Trump victory precisely for breaking up that Clintonian neoliberal order. Do you share any of that feeling of his?
Yeah, that's such a hard one. I'll tell you honestly, I didn't think that before the election, but I think that now, going forward, we should adopt that position, right? I think that's the best way to go forward rather than to revel in our misery, but to say, okay, now we've got, now, you know, what is the old, you know, expression from Mao, right? That everything is in crisis, the situation is excellent. So I think we have to proceed as if Žižek was right in saying that and use this as an opportunity. I mean, that's the only way forward. If not, what do? We just sit around miserable? That's not going to do anything for us.
That you wrote very eloquently on Facebook the other day about how liberals and Democrats were taking some kind of pleasure in their hatred of Trump. And, you know, now that he's the president-elect, which is still doesn't flow trippingly off the tongue, how do you see that developing? Will that libidinal pleasure in hating Trump persist in what strike me as highly unproductive ways in the coming months?
I think it's a real question. I don't have an answer for it. The way I think about this is I remember the libidinal pleasure that I had, and I don't think I was alone in this, in hating George W. Bush, hating him for his smirks, hating him for his embrace of torture, hating him for his war. So it's the combination of the reality of his horrible policies, but also the more visceral hatred of him. And so in some ways that might continue. I got to say, though, today it doesn't feel that way. Today it feels like the Democrats or the liberal Dems are looking for someone else to hate. And I think it might be the so-called deplorables. It might be the left. I don't know. I mean, I think that as leftists, what we need to do is to try to block that kind of hatred, reassemble in a more organized and positive direction. Because right now, I'm not sure if it can maintain the same kind of energy that it did during the election.
What happens when that kind of hate object is taken away or radically transformed? Isn't there some sort of void that has to be filled somehow?
Yeah, that's the problem, right? So, will there be a filling of the void, or will there be a restructuring? And I think what we need to push is don't try to find something else to hate, but push a restructuring of the energy. And it's possible, right? I mean, it's possible. to try to move forward. I think it's too early, and I don't want to say move forward in this, like, oh, we have to be unified kind of way. I think that's a little bit pointless. But I think working through in a way that says, okay, our hatred was not productive. I mean, that's a little bit too hopeful right now. I guess it's hard to see that it's going to fill the same function, because before, the hatred of Trump was what was filling the function of the absence of faith in and enthusiasm for Hillary. Right, so it had a real function for the liberal Democrats and the Democratic Party. And now without that function, where that's going to go, I don't know.
You mentioned two possible targets. I have experienced on Twitter, mostly, for what that's worth, when I point out the person who needs to be blamed most for this loss is Hillary Clinton herself. She was always a terrible candidate from the start. And I must admit, my feelings of shock and anxiety for the future are somewhat countered by my sense of vindication that I've been saying this for 2 years to relentlessly hostile reception. But now, you know, they just don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that that Hillary was always a bad candidate. They want to blame the racism and sexism of the white working class. That seems to be their favorite target now, as if these were immutable, almost natural phenomena. How do we deal with this?
Yeah, that's something that really, really worries me as well, that the Democrats in the mainstream will turn their hatred onto the white working class, because that's what's going to keep this kind of negative Trump formation intact, right? That's what it needed, was the anger and frustration of the working class, particularly the white working class, but not exclusively the white working class, but their sense that no one was speaking for them, their sense of being utterly screwed by the last 30 or 40 years of neoliberal policies. And so one of the things that we as the left have to make sure doesn't happen is that this becomes channeled onto the white working class. What we have to make sure is that it's clear that a broad working class rejected the Democratic Party, a very broad working class. And frankly, I think that where I want to project my anger and hatred right now is definitely onto the Democratic Party and onto Hillary Clinton for them trying to coronate her, them trying to tell us that she was entitled to this, when it was clear all the way through the election that the country was in a place that was anti-establishment, that was angry, and that could have been channeled in an egalitarian direction with Bernie Sanders. And what did the Democratic National Committee did? They screwed him out of the election. And now it's like, you know, democracy coming to bite them in the ass.
They not only screwed him, but they also they actually ran against his platform for a while. They were like running against the New Deal and social democracy, which is a remarkable thing to do. Somebody who had actually had some success in mobilizing this white working class through Medicare for all and free college tuition and, you know, basic social democratic benefits. They ran against that. They had surrogates saying, like, we don't get anything for free in America, and basically slapping people around with the neoliberal discipline. It was a remarkable development, and now they refuse to acknowledge any responsibility for this reaction.
Yeah, the Democrats were the ones who betrayed their own platform, and or, you know, their historical platform, if not their current one or the one from the last 20 years. And so they have only themselves to blame.
I was just watching Karl Rove on Fox a little while ago, and he said he was doing some focus groups with his PAC, America Rising, with elite and working class women. And they were responding to Hillary's message about how her victory, being the first woman president, would improve the lives of all women. He said that resonated with the elite women. It did not. It just died with a thud with working class women. Now, I have to wonder if Hillary's people did similar research and dismissed it, or what? But you know, what do you make of her appeal that she was every woman and was going to lift up women in general through her ascension?
It's really hard to fathom how this campaign apparatus that was supposed to be so nuanced, so data-driven, so focus group-oriented, missed the fact that so many women do not see themselves in the successes of the 1%. And I'm wondering if perhaps the Clintons' longstanding tie to a black professional elite, a black political class that has also been neoliberal that has also embraced a particular kind of market-driven orientation towards that kind of success, if they let those relationships give them the sense of what all women wanted. It's remarkable their blindness on that. And I should also say it's remarkable the blindness of the mainstream media in feeding all of this and refusing to take seriously the fact of economic inequality and division in the country. I live in upstate New York, rural area that went for Trump, and there were signs up here that said deplorable lives matter.
Which would immediately get them denounced as racist by the, metropolitan elites.
That's right. And, of course it's an appropriation of Black Lives Matter, but it's also a kind of cry about, what about us? And so I think that the rural, the left behind, the left out voices, if we didn't have Bernie Sanders to give them expression, it was clear Hillary Clinton couldn't, and so they went elsewhere. And that's the heartbreak.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Liberals, poring over the polling data, will argue that, just looking at the income profile of Trump's vote, refutes the working class resentment line, because his voting base was fairly prosperous. But if you look at the geographical distribution of his votes, places like upstate New York, which is quite a poor region, parts of it resemble Appalachia, you get the feeling that this working class analysis is correct. So how do we parse this?
Yeah, I think that this is challenging. I think that the one way to go about parsing that is to recognize maybe the fact that he won among non-college educated white men and non-college educated. Wait, and he also took 52%, I think it is, of women. So he was able to get a broad coalition of people who didn't feel recognized by Clinton. So maybe one way to figure this out is to say, what did she fail to do? Right? She failed to inspire people who she took for granted and who the Democratic Party had been taking for granted. And they took for granted an industrial working class that in fact Bill Clinton's trade policies dissolved. They took for granted women who her own success ignored. They even took for granted a Latino vote, which interestingly had a surprising turnout for Trump. I look at this as the condescension and elitism of the DNC is what lost the election for them. They took too many people for granted and didn't even try.
Now, something that complicates the racism narrative, which is the liberals' preferred narrative this morning as we record this, is that Hillary substantially underperformed Obama demographically and geographically, and there were regions around the industrial Midwest, for example, where there was like a 20-point swing from 2012's Obama vote to her vote this year. And, Obama's approval rating now is, 54%, 56%? It's the highest it's been perhaps since he took office. So that racism narrative is complicated.
Yeah, really complicated. And one of the ways that I've been thinking about it is racism is a feature in all of American politics and all of American life. It is not something unique to this election. And so it doesn't seem to me to be the key factor in explaining this election, right? Because it's always present, right? I mean, it's present in different ways at different times. Trump mobilized hatred in a direction that was familiar and useful. But I don't think that it would have been mobilizable if people felt happy and successful and felt like there was another choice that offered them, as Obama did, hope and change or something plausible, something plausible, something optimistic. And Hillary Clinton didn't do that, right? She talked, it was about her, always about her. And people did not see her as offering them a better life.
Yeah, I mean, the slogan, I'm with her, is centered on her, not about what she could do for you, or even like Obama's hope, which was empty, but at least somewhat effectively and oriented towards the future, is just all about her as the embodiment of our aspirations, especially the aspirations of professional class women.
That's right. Or every little girl who she always speaks about is sort of her imagined audience, which must be, in some ways, you know, her imagined, you know, younger self looking back at who she wanted to become or how she was supposed to be. But, like, I think in some ways that her constant appeal to her imagined little girls watching her, I mean, left out the working class women, single mothers, you know, women in families who are really struggling to get by. It left out so many. It was just her on stage and the little girls watching her, and no real women in between.
Also complicating the whole liberal explanation is that Obama, for all the right hated him, they couldn't make a scandal stick to him. He never had the problems of trustworthiness that she's had. He didn't have a smelly foundation or a secret email server and all these things. So there are such sharp differences between her and him that the liberals really don't want to process.
What's been hard for me to get my head around is why the liberals have refused to acknowledge this all the way through, right? Instead, whenever any of us would try to bring this up, instead what we got is, you know, Trump is horrible, Trump is horrible, Trump is horrible. Not, yes, there's a real problem here that needs to be kind of sensibly addressed. There's a problem with this candidate. And again, this is where, unfortunately, I think my recourse is quite childish, but I still am going to claim it. I told you so, I told you so, I told you so. Because that's what it is. That's what it, we knew this is what it was back when Bernie was running, which was, makes this thing so freaking horrible and heartbreaking. But we can't wallow in heartbreak. We've got to organize and do something better.
I can't say that I've been above the I told you so reaction. But when I do that, I get denounced for gloating or celebrating the victory of Trump or just treating myself as the one true progressive. That's what Rebecca Traister said to me on Twitter last night. I enjoy your celebration. You're the one true progressive.
Oh, God, that's so nasty. And actually, I wouldn't call you a progressive, Doug, which I think of as a compliment to you.
Thank you. I was like Alex Cobra's progressive, spelled with W. Their inability to see the problems with their own candidate and their own strategy and this 30 years of DLC politics is just remarkable. It does seem as if they were far more willing to crush the social democratic tendencies arising within the party during the primary season through Sanders. They'd rather lose than give those free rein.
The thing that I like to ask is, was it that they would rather lose? Or was it, like, so was it real hatred of social democracy, of some version of socialism, of universal rights, of real guarantees, or was it a sense of their own utter rightness, their own expertise, their own, they know better than everyone else? And I think it's that. I think that they have been so convinced that, and I think it's this insular beltway world, that they are so convinced that they know what's going on and everybody else is wrong, that they can't hear, they can't see. And so, the one hope is that maybe this really does rupture that and say, okay, look, you know, if we don't want the country going in an utterly authoritarian direction, then you have to open up and see that there is a place to develop an argument for, you know, universal guarantees, the social democracy that was at least aspired to in the 30s and 40s, that there is something else.
So now we have the usual closing questions. Where do we go from here? And it seems to me that the left, a very small formation, has at least two enemies to worry about. One, Trump, of course, but two, the Democratic establishment. We should really come out punching against the Democratic establishment and not be shy about the I told you so's, because I think that is essential to any kind of reconstruction of any left of center movement in the country. How do we fight these two battles at once?
That's a hard question. Let me first start with the going against the Democratic establishment part, because I think that's crucial. Because on that one, I see at least two options, other than the critique, right? We can keep making the critique, of course. But I think that the other option is, do we push for, let's say, a Sanders person as head of the DNC? Right? That strikes me as an immediate and practical approach for the aftermath and the rubble. It's like, okay, you Clinton people have clearly blown it just absolutely in a way that will probably harm the country for decades to come, given that the Republicans control all three branches of government, given that they also, you know, blocked Obama's Supreme Court appointment, so that they control everything. This is huge damage. And so what do we need to do? We need to make sure. So one thing would be, do we push for the DNC to restructure and have a Bernie Sanders person as the head of the DNC? That's one thing. Or, but this may be an and, do we really try to get all of the left and liberal and progressives to form a stronger alliance or party or something, whether or not it's something like the, you know, the conservative formation, or maybe, or, you know, where they're not a party but they occupy the Republican Party, or maybe it's something like a bigger emphasis on a new third party. Those to me seems to be the option. Do we try to take over the DNC by pushing this right now, or do we really pull together for a third party that can actually give a voice to unions, working class, and you know, serious socialists and social democrats and even communists? So I think that's a big question. In terms of fighting against Trump, I mean, one of the things that will build a left party is the organized demonstrations against Trump, the organized defense and alliance with people who are likely to be victimized by a Trump administration. So I think we can build the a strong left via the defenses of people attacked by Trump. And so that's a kind of nice way that you can do two at once. Does that make sense? Did I say that clearly enough?
No, that was very good. And what about Sanders himself? I mean, he could play, if he wanted to, a rather constructive role, I would think. He's got, you know, a large mailing list, a lot of names, some kind of organization. What can we hope for him to do going forward?
We could hope for him to step in a leadership role and offer some guidance, some steps, and a kind of maybe even a process for going forward. That would be good to see. I hope that he didn't lose too much credibility by supporting Hillary. I hope that his One Revolution, which I don't think was a great name, but his one, you know, his revolution group has enough credibility that he can fill this role. I don't think we know that today. It'll probably take a few weeks to see if he can do that.
That was Jody Dean, professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Her most recent book, and it's a very good one, is Crowds and Party from Verso. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Arise, ye ones, from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last vital let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last vital let us face. The Internationale unites the human race.
That was a bit of the Internationale performed by Alistair Hewlett. My next guest is Glenn Ford. He's the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, which you can find on the web at blackagendareport.com. This is kind of a vulgar journalistic question, Glenn, but how surprised were you by the election outcome?
I was very surprised. You know, I'm in the corporate media echo chamber, just like everybody else, and fully expected that Hillary Clinton, who had the benefit of having most of the ruling class in her big tent and most of the money available to her and all of the corporate media, that she would swamp Donald Trump. But I was wrong.
Well, how can we read this in class terms? Because as you say, the bourgeoisie was fully behind Clinton. Trump didn't get a single Fortune 500 CEO endorsement. Wall Street was clearly entirely behind the Clinton candidacy. What does this say about, first of all, bourgeois power, and what does it do to the American class structure? Do you have any sense of what that might mean?
Well, it certainly shows that the ruling class has a crisis of legitimacy, that they could proclaim that we are unified, and this is a quest on behalf of all Americans, and the corporate media in unison could be singing the same song, and yet a majority of the voters gave that song its middle finger and said, F you, and we want to go in a different direction.
Now, a lot of Democrats are, their diagnosis is that the Trump victory is produced by working class white racism and sexism. What do you think of that explanation?
Well, the Republican Party has been the white man's party. That is a party whose organizing principle is white supremacy since the 1960s. So, of course, racism, white supremacy, had a lot to do with this. But even deplorables, as Hillary Clinton called Trump's supporters, even deplorables want to have some kind of security. They want to have good jobs, too, even if they only want them for their own kind. So it's more complex than just white supremacy, more than just a victory of the white man's party. It's a rejection of the status quo, as Trump's followers see it, and explicitly of the rule of the rich. I think that that rhetoric was more pronounced on the Republican side than on the Democratic side once Bernie Sanders was out of the race.
And, of course, Hillary Clinton was a perfect, not merely symbol of, but embodiment of the you know, the plutocracy of the status quo, and the foundation of the email business. Is this the corruption and self-satisfaction and insularity and complacency and arrogance of these people? She embodied that.
Yeah, she was the personification of it all, and rejection of her is not a rejection of women. It's a rejection of this corporate woman.
Now, what about the Democratic Party? It's really suffered a very severe blow. The kind of centrist DLC ideology that's dominated the thing, especially through the personality of the Clinton family, over the last 25 years is in tatters now. What should we think of this institution? Will it be able to reform itself? Do we care about it? Do we want to see it die? What do you think?
We've been talking about reforming the Democratic Party forever. And the advocates of reform who always say, let's give it one more try every 4 years or so, preach a kind of incrementalism that isn't even grounded in history or in fact. Their theory is that incrementally all of their efforts to nudge the Democratic Party into some kind of social democratic kind of party has incremental results that bit by bit over time improve the lives of people. But that's not what's been happening over the past 40 years of this neoliberal era. What we've seen is the Democrats in a kind of dance of duopoly with the Republicans, where they hug as closely as possible to the Republicans' left flank and claim everything to the left of that as their own territory, and including this large group of social democratic voters, and that includes almost all black folks, whose agenda they have no intention of addressing. It is not incrementally progressive. It is incrementally and sometimes dramatically regressive. And that's why we now have Democrats who call themselves liberals, who are in fact to the right of Richard Nixon 45 years ago.
You mentioned black voters. It looks like the turnout was down. We don't know what combination of voter suppression and unwillingness to get out and vote for Hillary Clinton, you know, is responsible for that. But, you know, going back into the primaries, Hillary was able to use black voters in conjunction with upper-income whites to hold off the Sanders threat. What should we think about the role of the black vote in the Democratic Party from here on?
Well, you know, we've been burned by looking at these numbers compiled by these polling agencies, and it's only hours since the great burning of our sensibilities, numbers-wise. So I don't read those numbers as being anything like exact. But of course, President Obama was not able to transfer his relationship based on race with black America to Hillary Clinton. But I think it's also true. And I think the data that grew out of the primaries shows that we do have a new generation of black millennials that does not have this mystical kind of psychological connection with the Democratic Party, whose role models are younger people who are not affiliated with the party and who could not muster the enthusiasm to do the traditional service to the Democrats by voting for them.
So what should we do at this moment? In the past, when there's been a Republican victory, most liberals and Democrats will say, you know, what we need to do is just get another Democrat in there and everything will be okay. That may not work this time because the Democrats now seem so discredited and so bereft of any alternatives or any heirs to Hillary herself. Well, I think one of the reasons she was regarded as so inevitable is that there is not a whole lot of competition. The Democratic bench is rather thin at this point. So what's the best way to deal with this situation for people with our kinds of politics?
I think that Hillary Clinton's big tent should be allowed to fold. It shouldn't be pumped up again, that we need to think in terms not of these big tents, which are really places for the corporate folks in the Democratic Party to rule from. We should think in terms of yurts like the Mongols with whole cities of people in motion, some of it electoral, but most of it in social movements, and that's what we ought to be concentrating on. Whatever social democratic parties we try to build in the future have to be based on, and I'm talking about where the leadership comes from, based on social movements that we concentrate on. That's where the new folks are going to come from, not these retreads from the Democratic Party who have learned only in the last 40 years how to do that duopoly two-step dance with the Republicans.
And I guess we're participating to some degree here, but the way Americans organize politics around presidential elections is a great sucker of time and energy and intellectual power. Should we really think less about these things and think more about what goes on in the other years of the calendar?
Well, if you're in the Green Party and you've invested so many years and you've actually learned a lot in the arcane arts of getting on the ballot in the United States, you probably need to keep on doing what you're doing. But there should be a lot of disaffected people out here in this fallow ground, I hope, of social democratically oriented Americans that can help the Green Party not by indulging in the labor of getting on ballots, but by actually organizing people to bulk up the social democratic part. There's going to be several of them before it really several democratic socialist type organizations arguing among themselves before we see something that we could call the D1.
Now, what about that Green Party? It seems, you know, perpetually unable to organize itself beyond a very, very limited scope. Is it something we should just give some time to, or is it there's something wrong with the structure?
Well, members of the Green Party are engaged in deep argument about just that. Certainly it seems to be in the structure. Why do the same things happen over and over again? It's got to be in the DNA, and it needs some tinkering.
That was Glenn Ford, executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, blackagendareport.com, on the web. And finally, Alex Gurevich, an assistant professor of political science at Brown and a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard. He's one of the contributors to the blog The Current Moment, thecurrentmoment.wordpress.com.
How are you faring, Alex? Have you recovered from the shock of the news?
I have recovered a little bit, or at least I think by now I'm sort of less just sort of shocked and melancholy and more ready for a fight. I don't know what the fight looks like. That's what I'm puzzling about right now, but I kind of feel the itch to organize and do something. Just trying to figure out what that is.
And this is a debased journalistic kind of question, but how surprised were you by the outcome? Were you convinced that Hillary was the inevitable winner?
Yes. I mean, I was supremely confident that she was going to win, like I think a lot of people. But in some ways, I guess I'm not surprised, or I shouldn't have been surprised, I suppose.
So what do you attribute this strange turn of events to?
I think it's hard to say, but and my inclination is to say that the Democratic Party is responsible for not having beaten a candidate that they should have beaten handily. Let me say one thing before that, which is I attribute this to the lack of democracy in our country. She did win the popular vote. She got a majority of the, or a plurality of the votes cast. But our system is undemocratic. It doesn't allow majorities to rule in presidential elections. The Electoral College gave this election to Trump. And so the first thing I'd say is that the lesson here is not that democracy failed, but that we have too many constraints and limitations on democracy.
I'd either forgotten this or didn't know it, but, you know, the unlikely event that had gotten thrown into the House, each state would have had one vote, which would have been even more of a grotesque perversion of democracy.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely grotesque. I mean, there's some weird way in which this is the slaveholder's revenge, because the reason we have an electoral college at all is because as a concession to the slaveholding South. So at one level, I just say we don't have enough democracy here. And that's true at the level of the Electoral College. It's true because we have a really crappy way of organizing voting. We do it on a working day, which there should be a national holiday. We have various kinds of voter suppression and disenfranchisement. And despite all of that stuff, she still slightly won the popular vote. So my first thought is part of the reason that she lost is because you don't have enough democracy. But within that, we also have a very compromised Democratic Party that has just been failing to make a positive case for voting for it for a long time. It's just relied on lesser evilism plus demographics. And after a while, there's enough people who just seem to have been sick of that and were ready to vote against it despite some of the really horrific and vile aspects of Trump.
You wrote a very impressive blog post the other day about the Democratic Party. Could you reprise that argument?
Yeah, well, the blog post was actually one half of a talk I gave at Bridgewater State University, which is a public university in Massachusetts. And it was a talk I gave to some college students about the election. And basically what I was arguing was, look, vote or don't vote, but don't let that be the only thing you're going to do. And what I was trying to get at is that there's this weird thing about the lesser evil argument, the argument that just you have an obligation to vote for the lesser evil because if you don't, the greater evil is going to win, the apocalypse, the end of the republic, something like that. And my problem with that view is it does two contradictory things at once. On the one hand, it radically inflates the individual voter's responsibility for the outcome. But at the same time, it radically narrows our understanding of what it means to participate politically. So on the one hand, it says, look, you individually are responsible for the outcome of the election, which is an insane thing to say, because individually we make no difference in the outcome. There's no chance that one individual vote is going to be the deciding vote in election. The chance is so small, most calculators can't even represent it in the number of numerals available on them. So, and what I hate about that lesser evil argument is it just absolves representatives of the real, those are the people who are really responsible, of having to make their case. In this case, usually it absolves the Democrats of actually having to make a positive case of why we ought to vote for them. And so that side, which is what the blog post was mostly about, was to say, look, we're not responsible in that way. And that's just an excuse to harangue individual voters into feeling like they're responsible for the outcome. When in fact, that just reverses what democratic representation should be about, which is about trying to make a positive case to people, persuading them that you stand for something rather than just against something. And the blog post was mainly about that, but I'd say today I feel like it's the other side, which I didn't write about, but which was part of this talk.
Now, before I get to that, if I remember correctly, you made a very good point about the critique that Hillary types made of people who wanted to make what they called a protest vote.
Yeah, well, yeah, so they, you know, the thing you'd often hear is, oh, you're fantasists. You know, the people who want to make a protest vote or a write-in vote or refuse to vote, they're the fantasists. They refuse to face reality. They're irresponsible. They don't really know what politics is like. But actually, there's a way in which they're absolutely realistic. They recognize that one individual vote doesn't make a difference. And the people peddling the fantasy are the lesser evilists. When they say, you make the difference, you don't make the difference with regard to the outcome of the election. Which is, I think, a liberating thought. It means that you have to be free to actually consider principles and think about the options in front of you and decide whether everyone has made a sufficiently good case for voting for them. And underneath that, I sort of felt like for all that the lesser evilists say that it's the protest votes are doing expressive voting, there's something very expressive, non-pragmatic about this lesser evil vote, because it just turns into this act whereby you express your moral superiority for supposedly being more grounded in the realities of the situation. But it turns into just an excuse to harangue people who substantively disagree with you. I mean, in the end, I think a lot of this is just trying to conceal substantive disagreements between people on the left and the sort of neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party.
And there's always that accompanying con game where, you know, vote for the lesser evil now and we can fix things in the future, but that future never seems to arrive.
Well, that's it. So during elections, they always hold that out. But anybody who pays attention either to primaries or after elections knows that the same logic immediately applies. So in a primary, it was used to argue, well, Bernie shouldn't have even run because he was undermining and threatening Hillary and making it harder for her to win. So it turns out you're not even supposed to challenge the lesser evil candidate during the primary. And then afterwards, in policymaking, the same thing applies. Well, you're giving ammunition to the enemy, which is exactly what they said, for instance, during the debate on Obamacare. Oh, we can't talk about single payer or national health care or anything like that, because then they're going to call us crazy socialists and it's not going to be practical, so you need to shut up and get in line. Well, you know, at some point, this just becomes an instrument for demanding the left permanently support, or any dissenting group permanently subordinate itself to this particular faction of the Democratic Party. And it turns out even on its own terms now, it's false. This isn't realistic. This doesn't turn out to be the best way to win elections.
Yeah, and this election revealed that Obamacare has little, if any, constituency.
Yeah, well, that's the really striking thing. I mean, I don't know what to think about that. It's possible that its constituency is relatively small and not sufficient to have made a difference in any of the relevant elections, but I mean, it's designed in this baroque, tortured way that even people who benefit from it it's such a punishing process. I know people who have tried to find insurance on those exchanges, and while I know that they're glad to have some health care, it's so expensive and so difficult to understand what the hell's going on, and your policy can be pulled because an insurer can decide they're not going to offer anything, that even those who benefit seem to, at least some of them, it seems to be not a sufficient benefit to stake a vote on. I'm not of the view that things have to get worse before they get better, I don't think that's always true. I don't think it's often true. But it might end up being the case for Obamacare. Maybe it'll just show, look, you need to have single payer because there's no way to actually cover everyone and control costs in this weird way. But whatever it is, I think you're right. There's no constituency for it.
I'm speaking with Alex Gurevich, who teaches political science at Brown.
And then now on to the unpublished second part of your talk to Bridgewater. What was that about?
Well, so then, my thought is, look, at the end of the day, if you want to vote strategically, that's fine. There's certainly reasonable arguments to vote for the lesser evil, despite the many problems with it. But the strange thing about it is it's also sort of radically narrows what's expected of us. All of this energy, 600-day election, all this energy and endless conversation just about how you're going to vote, what you're going to do for like 30 minutes of your life. And then you're kind of expected just to go home and let the experts take over. But that seems like an incredible narrowing of what's expected, what ought to be actually expected of us, and where we really stake out who we are politically. Because there, what matters is, you know, whether people are going to spend time after the election organizing and mobilizing, both to resist whatever the hell it is that Trump's going to throw at us. And I have to admit, I'm not really clear on what he's going to do.
I'm not even sure he is.
Well, that's it. You know, I mean, he sort of flip-flops between not clearly wanting to govern at all and seeming to want to hand domestic policy over to basically Pence and Ryan. But on the other hand, he surely is going to feel vindicated that he won, and vindicated not against the pollsters, but the Republican leadership. And he might come to think that he can just do whatever he wants. And some of it's going to be crazy stuff. I mean, I'm sure he's going to reorganize. He's going to change what the degree the executive controls things like law enforcement standards and priorities, immigration control, deportation procedures, all this stuff. He doesn't even need to cooperate with Republicans on that stuff. And it's all going to be bad. There's going to be evil stuff that we'll want to be organizing against. But even more than that, I mean, what I've been thinking about today especially is not just what we'll organize against, but what are we going to organize for? You know, I mean, I do think that this election, you know, has struck a real blow to lesser evil kind of democratic politics. It's not enough to just offer fear plus demographics. But it's not clear. There's nothing really waiting to take over. I mean, Bernie Sanders isn't coming back. There were some really good ideas, I think, in that campaign. I'm kind of glad in a way he's not coming back, because I think, you know, he was good as a primary challenge. But I think what we need is more than just like a charismatic candidate at the national level. We need all those molecular, cellular forms of social organization and local party structures that can develop into, in the long run, an alternative to the Democratic Party.
He never missed an opportunity to make that point. He did say, you need to organize. I can't do it.
I agree. All I'm saying is that I would kind of rather that he isn't the figurehead for it. That's all I mean. I totally agree with it, but I think in some ways, like, it's better that it not look like, you know, the road not taken from 40 years ago. But yeah, so it needs a small political point. I mean, and if he does decide to step up, if nobody else is, you know, power to him. But in a way, my point is just, it's local level, long-term, hard local level organizing over the course of years, which I have to say is another reason to just dispense with the lesser evil thinking. Lesser evil thinking is so short-term. It's always about how do we win the next election? We can't let the other guys win. But you're never allowed to devote your resources to the longer-term stuff. And also, it's never permissible to engage in things that might mean strategic defeat for long-run victories. So it's easy to say that. I don't know what exactly we ought to be doing, but I do think that what we are responsible for, what we really ought to feel the weight of, is now what we're going to do with our time starting, you know, today.
Presidential campaigns have become not only such a hog for our attention, they've become the focus of all kinds of politics, and even the Green Party, which has many, many problems, but one of them is that they focus so much attention on this quadrennial ritual of running a presidential candidate and don't do anything appreciable to organize at any lower level. All these, you know, like Harvard grads like Jill Stein want to run for president, but nobody wants to run for city council.
I know. Yeah, I mean, power to Kishana Sawant, you know, I actually don't. At least, you know, running locally.
Yeah. You know, we're almost out of time here, but what kind of issues or agenda do you think that kind of local organizing would be most effective around?
Honestly, my favorite issue is local labor organizing. Labor and immigration seem to me, because since they're intersecting anyway, but, I mean, what are the social organizations that are able to kind of be the bearers of these progressive ideas? It sounds like a traditional thing to say, but there's no clear alternative to powerful, radical labor unions. And I think that's true not just for sort of the straight social justice issues or, you know, social democratic welfare proposals, but even for some of the things that came up about, like, racial justice. And I was just learning, just reading the other day that the single most successful act of desegregation turned out to be Medicare. Medicare overnight, quietly and instantaneously desegregated all the hospitals in the South, because in order to receive federal funding, they had to desegregate. And notably, this was a social policy based on appealing to both poor whites and poor blacks for access to universal access to Medicare. So I guess what I'd say is organizing on the basis of common appeals to poor whites and poor blacks, which is the one thing that the Democrats really have failed to do, and where I think something like a left alternative could really start to have an impact. And I can't think of anywhere you start that's better than, you know, progressive labor movement organizing. I mean, it sounds traditional, but until I hear a better idea, that just seems to be the place to start.
That was Alex Gurevich, an assistant professor of political science at Brown and a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard. He writes some excellent material for The Current Moment, thecurrentmoment.wordpress.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. A little bit more of Alistair Hewlett during the Internationale. Till next week, bye.
No more deluded by reaction, on tyrants only we'll make war. The soldiers too will take straight action, they'll break ranks, they'll fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to the fry, they soon shall hear the bullets flying. We'll shoot the generals on our own side. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race.